Okay, good morning. Good evening, everybody. Monday night, Chol HaMoed Pesach. Tomorrow night starts the holiday all over again. It is April 10 of the year 23. Welcome aboard, everybody who's calling in. I know we have at least one participant calling in. Very nice. Thank you so much. This is a slightly different time, obviously, than we normally have for book club class at Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. We had some fun this afternoon. I joined the family. We drove around. We did this and that. And there was just no way to do book club at 1 o'clock. Delighted we can do it now at 9:30. We've done our davening and we did our eating. And that's about as good as an exercise program as we're going to get around here in this hotel. And we are enjoying it very much. It's a fun place to be. Okay, live from Oppenheimer's. Let's get into it. We're doing the book, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, Volume 1. And hopefully what happened the other day, where it stopped recording at 24 minutes, will not happen tonight. Okay, I'm going to try to get my kids to come up here and hear some of the story. Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. Now, that individual, Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, is the Beis Halevi. Okay, we have to distinguish between one rabbi and the other. Both have the same names. Rabbi Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University, well, yes, his name was Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik. He is named for his great-grandfather. Okay? He's not named for his grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rather, he's named for his great-grandfather. He carried the same name as his great-grandfather, the Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi, that's how we're going to distinguish them, between Rabbi Soloveitchik, who we're talking about, and his great-grandfather, the Beis Halevi. The Beis Halevi lived in the mid-1800s. That's when he flourished. I mean, he wound up taking rabbinical position in Brisk. And then he was also, for a time, was also the Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin. That had a very storied career, super scholar. And he began the Soloveitchikian rabbinical dynasty. Okay, let's get right to it. I'm on page 174. Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, Modern Clothes. This story was related by Rabbi Soloveitchik to his Talmud class when the author was a student at YU. The Rav related that he had heard from his father the following reason for his great-grandfather, the Beis Halevi's, temporarily leaving Russia and moving to Galicia. Okay? So the Beis Halevi was confronted by the Russians and their anti-Semitism, and he moved out. That's here. In the late 1840s, during the reign of Tsar Nicholas I, the Jews of Russia were forbidden to wear their traditional garb. The Beis Halevi felt that such a governmental decree had as its goal the prohibition of Jewish religious practice. In such a case, the governmental edict would be subsumed under the Talmudical prohibition of even changing one's shoe strap, to the Gemara Sanhedrin 74a and b. This means that when religion itself is persecuted, even the most insignificant religious custom or habit must be defended at all costs. So, in other words, if you know that the secular authorities are making a decree, you can't wear Jewish clothes, and you're an intelligent enough person to know they're not going to stop there. They're going to just keep on going. Well, as soon as they decree you cannot wear traditional Jewish clothing, at that point you've got to jump up and down and insist on indeed wearing Jewish clothing. You can't give in an inch if they're going to start prohibiting Jewish religious practice. So then the Talmud says, even changing one's shoe strap, you're not allowed to do. So the Russians are saying, do not wear Jewish clothing anymore. The Talmud responds, well, then we're not going to change a single thing about our Jewish clothing, and we're going to continue to wear it. We don't care what you say. Let's see what the Beis Halevi did. Rabbi Yosef Ber, the Beis Halevi, therefore decided to move to Brody in Galicia. So listen to this rationale. Since the Jews there already wore modern clothing, he would be able to change his style of dress in the new location. And so he did, apparently. 2 years later, the Beis Halevi returned to Russia and continued to wear modern clothing. Now, however, it was not because of the Tsar's decree, but rather a continuation of his Galician practice. That is the most unusual story you're going to find among rabbis. When confronted by this anti-Semitic decree by the Russian authorities, it seems, and forgive me for saying this, but instead of fighting it and wearing your Jewish clothing in the face, in the very teeth of the Russians and their hatred, instead of wearing your traditional Jewish clothing, he moved out. And he moved to a place where they wear modern clothing. He then felt perfectly comfortable adopting modern clothing wearing. So he certainly could have continued to wear his rabbinical, you know, his very traditional, you know, Jewish clothing. Instead, he moved to a town where it was kind of cosmopolitan, and he decided to dress like everybody else dressed. And then 2 years later, he moved back to Russia. And now he feels I'm off the hook because, I mean, I now am wearing modern clothing, so that's pleasing to the Russian authorities. And the reason why I'm doing it is not because I'm complying with the Russian order. It's because, well, I just simply moved to a different city and I adopted their clothing. And now here I am continuing to wear their clothing back in my hometown. What doesn't make any sense is why he felt, you know, that he could change his clothing in Brody. Just simply keep on wearing your traditional Jewish garb and don't follow the locals in Brody and Galicia. Just keep on wearing your, you know, your Hamisha, Hasidisha, well, in this case, very Lithuanian rabbinical, you know, maybe dark, long black coat or whatever. But instead, no, he adopted maybe a short jacket. Who can know exactly what it looked like? But the point is that it's a very strange way to deke around the Russian authority thing, and he moves back to Russia, and he's complying now with the Russian governmental decree, but he knows that that's not where it's going to end. He knows that it can't end over there because that's not the way the Russians play. The Russians want to, you know, wipe out Judaism, let's say. So the whole action, while it may have complied with the letter of the law and the Talmud, strikes me as being very, very much not in the spirit of things. If the Talmud says, don't even change a shoe strap, well then don't change a shoe strap. Stick it out in Russia and fight them. Instead, he moves away and he goes to a more modern city and he adopts their modern clothing. And then inexplicably, he goes back to Russia. Why would you do that if you know that they've got a campaign that's out to crush Judaism? The whole thing is very strange. It's a very strange story. Now, he may have kept the letter of the law, but I don't see how he kept the spirit of the Talmud there at all. I think that as a rabbi of his stature, he should have put up a big fight and continued to wear his clothing that he has to wear according to the Talmud and fight it out, and that's it. He obviously didn't agree with me. But how is he keeping the Talmud? How is he complying with it? I don't know. I don't get that. Okay, we continue. Now we're on page 175. We're talking about the Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Beis Soloveitchik, who lived in the mid-1800s, the great-grandfather of Rabbi Joseph Beis Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University. Now we'll hear about the Slutsk Rabbinate. Here's a story. This is related by Rabbi Heschel Schachter in his book, Nefesh HaRav. When the Slutsk Rabbinate was offered to the Beis Halevi in the year 1865, there was a Malamed named Reb Mendele Epstein, who passed in 1875, who lived in the community in Slutsk. Excuse me. Reb Chaim later declared that he, Reb Chaim, had derived what became known as the Brisker Method from the teachings of Reb Mendele. Can you imagine? Reb Mendele Epstein, an unknown Malamed, came up with the Brisker Derech that Reb Chaim Brisker became world famous for and popularized. But it was from some unknown Malamed. That's, friends, that's who was living in Europe at the time. You know, in Lita, you had milkmen and balagolas. These were wagon drivers, and they were Torah scholars. Incredible thing. Reb Chaim later declared that he had derived what became known as the Brisker Derech from the methods of the teachings of Reb Mendler. When the Ksav Rabbanut, when the appointment to the rabbinate was officially presented to the Beis HaLevi, the Beis HaLevi noticed that Reb Mendler was not among the signatories. For this reason, the Beis HaLevi declined the rabbinate, citing the Talmudical dictum, in a place where there is a man to teach Torah, there you should not be a man. I guess that means if you already have a leader in place, don't feel you've got to be another leader. You can feel comfortable being a congregant and being a follower and being part of the community. That's what I'm getting from that Gemara in Brachos 63a. In a place where there is a man, where there indeed is a man to teach the Torah, so there, don't be a man. Since Reb Mendler was already in Slutsk, it wasn't right that the Beis HaLevi should also reside there. The community already had. It was clear, according to the story, it was not right for the Beis HaLevi to move to Slutsk and take the position of rabbi because the community already had an outstanding Torah teacher. On learning of the Beis HaLevi's decision, Reb Mendler went to Volozhin because, as you know, that's where he... That's where the Beis HaLevi was co-Rosh Yeshiva for a while within the Tziv in Volozhin. Reb Mendler met with the Beis HaLevi and assured the Beis HaLevi that despite his own scholarly ability, he, Reb Mendler, did not possess communal leadership traits. The Slutsk community needed a leader. And in this respect, it was appropriate to apply another Talmudical dictum, quote, in a place where there is no man, be a man there. Same Gemara in Brachos 63a. So if you already have a man in place, don't be a man, meaning don't feel the need to shtel zech for and put yourself out there and be a leader if there already is a leader. But in a place where there is no man, so there, be a man. Reb Mendler urged the Beis HaLevi to accept the appointment to the rabbinical position of Slutsk. Only then did the Beis HaLevi agree to the offer, and he became the rabbi in Slutsk. Another story, 12,000 signatures, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture on Parshas Ki Tisa in 1981 at Yeshiva University. I once heard a story which happened in Brisk. This is Rabbi Soloveitchik speaking. It took place after Rabbi Moshe Yoshua Yehuda Leib Diskin left his Brisk rabbinate to go on Aliyah in 1877. This is, of course, famous Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin. Okay? Very famous. So he was a Rav in Brisk, and he moved to Israel in 1877. He settled in Yerushalayim and was one of the founders of the Eidah Haredus, the independent Orthodox community. Rabbi Yeshua Leib had to leave Brisk because he got into trouble with the Russian government over children who were forcibly conscripted for the Tsar's army. The government would kidnap Jewish children and send them thousands of miles away from their parents to be raised in Russian towns so they later could be incorporated into the army. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, my great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, was then elected to the Brisk rabbinate. It's true. He took over for Rabbi Yeshua Leib Diskin, who went on Aliyah in 1877. So it was then, presumably, when the offer to become the rabbi of Brisk was offered to the Beis HaLevi in 1877. Okay, so he became the rabbi of Slutsk, as we said earlier, in 1865, and he was there for about 12 years, and then on to Brisk. So he says, my great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, was then elected to the Brisk rabbinate. He was in doubt about accepting this office. He had qualms because he realized that this position would entail many problems. The Beis HaLevi was not sure of himself. One of the leaders of the Brisk community said to him, you must accept the position.
12,000 Jews have signed the appointment to the rabbinate, your rabbinical appointment to the Bris community. When the Beis HaLevi heard this, he had to agree to accept the rabbinate. Such arguments work. Another story, the Treif chicken, all about the Beis HaLevi. In 1930, this is by Rabbi Soloveitchik, gave a Mishnayos shiur on the yahrzeit of his mother in 1968. He writes, in 1935, I was in Chicago. I had given a few shiurim in the Skokie Yeshiva, the Hebrew Theological College of Skokie, and I was invited to address the Chag HaSmicha, a celebration of rabbinical ordination. After I spoke, a man who was in his 80s came over to me and shook hands. He told me that he had known my great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi of Brisk. This man had left Brisk during the wave of massive emigration in 1880 or 1881. He told me the following story, which he was sure I did not know, about my great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi. Before he left, he had gone through Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, the Beis HaLevi, to get a blessing from him. My great-grandfather told him to sit down and remain in his study. The man remained sitting and observed how the Brisker Rav, the Beis HaLevi, received people and answered questions. An hour passed and the man became restless. Nevertheless, he revered the Brisker Rav, the Beis HaLevi, and he did not want to leave. He could have told the Beis HaLevi that he was busy and had to pack. He did not want to go against the Rav's wishes. Finally, he asked the Rav how much longer he must remain. The Rav motioned him to wait a little longer. After the passage of several hours, a little girl came in with a shayla, a question, about the kashrus of a freshly slaughtered chicken. Rav Yosef Ber, the Beis HaLevi, opened up the chicken and took a look. He told the girl to tell her mother that the chicken was treif. Right away, Rav Yosef Ber, the Beis HaLevi, motioned to the man to come over. He came over, and the Beis HaLevi asked him, "Did you hear what I told the girl?" "Of course," that was the reply. "You said that this chicken was treif." The Rav then showed him why. There was a needle that had perforated the body cavity of the fowl. "How did the chicken pick up the needle?" Rav Yosef Ber asked. "The answer is that it is the nature of a hen to pick for food in a pile of garbage. She does not discriminate between right and wrong, between filthy and clean, between what's defiled and what's fit for human consumption. That is how the needle entered the chicken." "Right. The same is true of humans," said the Beis HaLevi. "At times, they also rummage in the rubbish, in the garbage. They don't discriminate. I understand that you're going to a land where there are many such people. They do anything to earn a living and do not discriminate. I know that you'll have to earn a living there. But be sure not to emulate this chicken and to live like a Jew. Retain your sense of distinction," end quote. The man never desecrated Shabbos during his time in the United States. How about that? That's great. He distinguished himself. Top page 178, Shalosh Shittos, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik to his Talmud class at YU on Yom HaAtzma'ut in 1969. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, "My great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi, visited a small town where he spent Shabbos. He asked for challah so he could eat the Suda Shlishi, third meal. Some of the townsmen jested that there was no need for challah because there was an opinion that the obligation of the Suda Shlishi could be fulfilled with words of Torah. That's, in other words, instead of eating Shalosh Shittos, you say over some vetluch, you say over a whole Torah piece, that's going to be the equivalent of Shalosh Shittos.
That's like a meal. It fills you up."
Right. So Rabbi Yosef Ber, the Beis HaLevi, responded as follows. Listen to this. While words of Torah could perhaps substitute for the Shalosh Shittos, there was still one problem. There was always a chance that the individual's new, innovative insights of Torah thoughts would be refused. If they were negated, then the fulfillment of Shalosh Shittos would be eliminated.
If you have a vort and somebody shrugs it up, what'd you accomplish? You didn't say over any Torah because it was shrugged up. So therefore you had Torah, but you didn't because there's nothing there at the end of the day. And you didn't eat, you didn't have any Torah, so you lost out. Sarah.
That sounds like my mother's interpretation for why there is no mitzvah for Magid. Because let's say one of the children does not accept the answer that is given for any of the four questions, well, then the mitzvah, is that correct? Then the mitzvah,
that is very close to what I was saying. He got it to Levincho by Yomahu. So maybe the bed is not accepting it, but I'm not sure that that's the right answer. But I was basing it on the mitzvah stuck. I think, what if the person says Baruch Atah Hashem, there's no bracha on tzedakah. Elkeinu Malach Olam, whatever, to give tzedakah.
And you give to a guy.
And then he gives the guy, and he hands over the money to the guy, and the guy refuses to accept it.
You made a bracha and not for nothing.
Right, so I don't remember if he says that, but I was trying to see if Magid was similar to that one.
Fascinating. Interesting stuff. Okay. Got to explore. Says the Beis HaLevi, there was always a chance, he says, that the individual's new chiddush of Torah thoughts would be refuted. If they were negated, then the fulfillment of Shalosh Shittos would be eliminated. Therefore, says the Beis HaLevi, let me stick with challah. It can never be refuted once I eat it. Who says Litvaks don't have a sense of humor? How about a story about the singing maid? This is a pretty, well-known kind of a story. Related by the Boston Rebbe, Rebbe Levi is called the Rebbe Lora Horowitz. In 1993, the Rebbe spoke about his great-grandfather, the Beis HaLevi. When in Varsha, he decided to visit Rabbi Yaakov Gesundheit. That was his name. The community's rabbi, Rabbi Gesundheit. Can you imagine if the man sneezed and you say Gesundheit? It wouldn't be respectful to say Gesundheit to Rabbi Gesundheit. You probably have to say Rabbi Gesundheit.
Rabbi Yaakov Gesundheit.
How about that? But that was his name, Rabbi Yaakov Gesundheit. He was the community's rabbi in Warsaw. They were seated in the living room, the Beis HaLevi, who was visiting Warsaw, and they suddenly heard the Jewish maid in the kitchen start to sing. Rabbi Yaakov immediately stood up and angrily walked in the direction of the kitchen to stop the singing of the maid. The Beis HaLevi also rose and pulled his host aside. The rabbi of Warsaw asked the Beis HaLevi why he stopped him. I'll explain my actions, said the Beis HaLevi. Your maid works hard. The only enjoyment and pleasure she has is singing. It's true that we're enjoined from listening to her singing, but we can step outside or we can go into a different room. However, you want her to stop singing. That's not fair. It's your only enjoyment. Thinking about other people. Enmity between litigants. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who is the father of the Rav, told the Rav a story that his father, Rav Chaim Brisker, related to him. A lot of Soloveitchiks running around that little sentence over there. So Rabbi Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University. Okay, let's get one Soloveitchik down the time. Says that his father, Rav Moshe, told him a story about the Zayda, the grandfather of Chaim Brisker.
So basically, one Soloveitchik is being told a story from another Soloveitchik about another Soloveitchik.
That's right.
And then what was it called Rav Chaim Brisker if his name was Soloveitchik?
Everybody knew him as Rav Chaim Brisker. Because he was the rabbi in Brisk. Famous Rav Chaim Brisker, the originator of the Brisker Derech.
But his name was
Soloveitchik. There was once a difficult din Torah regarding civil litigation in the Bezdin of Chaim's father, the Beis HaLevi. I said we're going to call Rabbi Yosef Ber Soloveitchik of the 1800s. He's the great-grandfather of Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik of YU, and we call him the Beis HaLevi. The two litigants shouted at and cursed each other. Even the Beis HaLevi and his Dayanim were not spared from the maledictions of the disputants. Wow. The clamor was so great that the members of the Soloveitchik family were frightened by what was happening in the Beis HaLevi study. After the litigation ended
and the participants left, Reb Chaim Brister approached his father, the Beis Halevi. Reb Chaim inquired why there had been so much enmity and vehemence between the litigants if the entire Din Torah concerned a relatively small amount of money. After all, Reb Chaim Brister stressed, many times he had witnessed his father declare an animal not kosher after its slaughter. Then there really was a great loss of money involved. Then there was a great loss of money involved in that particular instance. And yet the owners of the animals accepted the Beis Halevi's decisions with equanimity. They went along with it, with respect. Whatever you say, Rabbi. Yet over here, small amount of money, they're yelling and screaming at each other. What's going on? So Beis Halevi responded that there was a basic difference between the two types of rulings. When you must decide about the kosher status of an animal, your decision does not reflect upon the people requesting the ruling. Therefore, when you tell the inquirer that the animal is not kosher, he's not offended, he's not insulted. You said to him, the chicken is treif, the cow is treif. Now, it's painful, you know, you're out money from the animal, but at least your own personal integrity has not been offended. Okay?
Because this animal wouldn't be sold and not going to be able to sell, so no one will know about it. Plus,
remember what the logic is? Logic is that when you're personally involved in something, then you get hurt. But when it's an animal that you own and you want to know if the slaughter was correct, if the chicken is treif or the cow is treif, then you go to the rabbi. He says, no, it's not kosher. Sorry, it's treif. You shrug your shoulders, okay. You know, I'm out $1,000 for the cow, but I don't care. I'll get another cow. But if the rabbi says, you are wrong, you and your decision-making and your actions are wrong, that's a whole other thing, and it hurts a lot to be told by a rabbi that you made a mistake. You are wrong in your actions. And that's where he's going with this. Okay? When you must decide about the kosher status of an animal, your decision does not reflect upon the people requesting the ruling. Therefore, when you tell the guy that the animal is treif, he's not offended. He's not insulted. Even if there's a great monetary loss involved, he accepts that ruling with understanding. The rabbi said, you know, there's a punctured lungs, it's over. Not kosher. Okay, yeah. That's in contrast to litigation concerning a monetary dispute. Here, the inference of the decision rendered will be that one of the litigants has acted improperly. It's not just that one party is obligated to pay. There's an implication that he's guilty of misbehavior. As a result, there's overwhelming tension and emotion in such cases. Even if it's only an insignificant sum, the parties will display deep enmity toward each other and even toward the Beis Din. Painful. We'll go to another 15 minutes. Now we'll do a piece about Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. The Brisker, Reb Chaim Brisker, apparently the originator of the Brisker Derech, but now we've just learned that there was a Malamed in Slutsk who developed the Brisker Derech, Reb Mendel.
Then why is it named after the Brisker?
Because he popularized it more than anybody, and he wrote it down so people could learn it. How about that? That's my best theory. Sukkos in Volozhin, related by the Boston Rebbe in 1993. The Rav related that his grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker, spent the first Sukkos after his wedding with his father-in-law, Reb Rafal Shapira, the Volozhin Rosh Hashiva. It was raining very hard on the first night of Sukkos. Reb Rafal felt that they should wait until midnight before eating, in the hope that the rain would stop, and then they could eat in the Sukkah. Reb Chaim contended that they could eat right away, in accordance with the principle that a person, quote, in distress, is exempt from the requirement to eat in the sukkah. Wow. On Shmini Atzeres, it was raining again, and the same problem surfaced. Only this time, Reb Rafal felt that they should eat in the house, while Reb Chaim was of the opinion that they should wait for the rain to stop so they could eat in the sukkah. Lipshitz Shapira Soloveitchik got upset with her husband and wanted to know why he always took issue with her father's views. Reb Chaim explained that the first night of Sukkos is a Torah obligation, Therefore, one may be lenient when the halacha permits such action, as in the case of rain. However, eating in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres is only a rabbinical decree. Such edicts have to be strengthened, and therefore, it is imperative to try and eat in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. How about that? If you want to see more about eating in a sukkah on Shmini Atzeres in the diaspora, in the Gola, see the Gemara Sukkah 47a. Okay, here's a story about Rav Chaim Brisker, or called Intellectual Honesty, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik as a Talmud lecture in Mark. Talmud relates that Rav Acha, the son of Rav Iker, found that he contradicted himself. A Gemara in Krisos 3b. He then tried to refute himself. There is a Musar Haskel, an instructive lesson in this approach. It means that if you realize that there is some contradiction pertaining to your statement, then you must refute yourself. Otherwise, it's impossible to know the Torah if one is vain and proud. One must be able to admit mistakes. This was the greatness of my grandfather, Rav Chaim Brisker. He always admitted when he made mistakes. He always admitted when he, Rav Chaim Brisker, made mistakes. I've already told you that when Rav Chaim was appointed Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, he was very young. There was opposition because of his youth, and Chaim the chemist, because his method resembled that of an analytical chemist. They used to call Rav Chaim Brisker the chemist, because his method resembled that of an analytical chemist. For instance, there was the Kletzke Rav of a Shalom Dov Ber Herenson, or the rabbi of Kletz from 1841 to 1866, author of Hechale Shen. He was so in disagreement with Rav Chaim Brisker's new method that he brought charges before the board of trustees of the yeshiva. How about that for seriousness? He so disagreed with Rav Chaim Brisker that he brought up charges before the board of directors of the yeshiva. The Kletzke Rav claimed that Rav Chaim Brisker did not teach Torah properly, and that his method was strange. The board of trustees consisted of Rav Reuven Halevi Duneberger, the rabbi of Duneberg or Divinsk, and author of the Rosh Lerevani. Also, the board consisted of Rav Yitzchak Yochanan Spector, then the rabbi of Kovna, for whom the rabbi Isaac Yochanan Theological Seminary of YU is named. Also on the list on the Beis Din was Rav Yitzchak Slonimer. That's Rabbi Yeshua Yitzchak Shapiro, also known as Rabbi Yitzchak Tarif, and a few others. This is the board of directors of the yeshiva. They were among the Gedolei Hador, the rabbinic leaders of the generation. So they came to Volozhin to investigate the matter. They did not know Rav Chaim, who was then a young man. He was in his 20s at the time. They came to listen to his shiur and to learn what it was all about. The shiur would determine whether Rav Chaim Brisker would be a Rosh Yeshiva or not. They all came, and Rav Chaim Brisker went up and said a shiur on Yevamos. The onlookers felt that the content was good and were impressed with Rav Chaim as a teacher. He was a born pedagogue and a born speaker. He was not a trained orator, nor had he cultivated his oratorical ability. Yet as a teacher, he was b'chesed elyon, par excellence. So he said the shiur, and the visiting rabbis were just enchanted. Toward the end of the shiur, Rav Chaim recalled a passage from Maimonides, which he felt refuted his analysis. It was about 5 minutes before the completion of his shiur. Had Rav Chaim finished the shiur, he would have gone down and there would have been a spontaneous outcry of "Long live the King" from all the audience. However, Rav Chaim suddenly interrupted the shiur. This is a true story. It's not just a Hasidic Shemaisa, because it's not a Hasidic Shemaisa. It is a true story. There was laughter in the audience back in 1994. Oh, he said over 1974. Because it's not a Chassidus Shemaisa, it's a true story. Rav Chaim declared, "Rabbi Sai, whatever I said is wrong. I made a mistake. The Rambam says just the opposite." Then he went down from the podium. Rav Chaim remained the Rosh Yeshiva. He did not lose his job. This is seeking the truth of Torah. I remember as a child that my father trained me in a similar fashion. Whenever there is a mistake, admit it immediately. Do not try to defend errors. That's what Rav Acha, the son of Rav Ika, did. He declared that what he had said before was no good. That's exactly what Rav Chaim did. Yes, there had to be a mistake over there. He declared that what he had said before was no good. Well, here's the point. Whenever there is a mistake, admit it immediately. Don't try to defend errors. That's what Rav Acha did back in the day in the Amoraic period. He declared that what he had said before was no good. And that's what Rav Chaim did. Rav Chaim gave a shear and said, whatever I just said is no good. Well, that's intellectual honesty par excellence. At that time, Rav Reuven Dannenberger gave Rav Chaim smicha. Rav Reuven was the most preeminent among the visiting rabbis. Actually, he was the Gadol Hador, the rabbinic leader of his generation. He invited Rav Chaim Brisker to Dannenberg, where they discussed many Talmudic topics together. Rav Reuven then gave Rav Chaim Brisker smicha. The fact that he gave him smicha meant that he sanctioned the appointment. In other words, he approved Rav Chaim Brisker and his derech of learning. The opponents of Rav Chaim Brisker claimed that the Netziv had appointed Rav Chaim because of nepotism, giving favors to family relatives. After all, Rav Chaim was the husband. Rav Chaim Brisker was the husband of Rabbi Herschel Leib's granddaughter. Rav Chaim Brisker was married to Lipscher, the daughter of the Netziv son-in-law of Rav Shapiro. That was the charge which Rav Chaim's opponents brought against him. Okay. However, the students of the yeshiva were behind Rav Chaim. They supported him to such an extent that when Rav Herschel Leib later appointed his son, Rav Chaim Berlin, to be his successor, the students did not accept the appointment. Well, my grandfather was at Yeshiva Volozhin. The appointment of Rav Chaim Brisker as the next head of the yeshiva did not have any chance of success. A son is a son. And Rav Chaim Berlin was a tremendous bucky. He was conversant with all aspects of rabbinic thought. However, he did not have a profound analytical approach. Rav Chaim Berlin was a tremendous bucky, but in the sense of the scholarship of the Stechemet, it was in the style of the Bekiyas and Sephardic rabbis, like Rav Avi Yosef, able to shatz ois one's intellectual achievements. Rabbis of great stature are able to evaluate other great rabbis and their intellectual ability and their scholarship. So in this case, there was a consensus that Rav Chaim Berlin was a tremendous bucky, meaning he had great breadth of information. He was familiar with all the concepts in the Talmud and in the codes of Jewish law. However, people felt that while it's true that he was a tremendous bucky and an expert in all the concepts in the Torah, however, he did not have a profound analytical approach. He didn't have a beitos, but he didn't have depth. And so he just didn't make it. Okay. He had no chance of success. Being appointed the next head of the Volozhin Yeshiva. Rav Chaim Berlin was a tremendous bucky, but in the sense of the scholarship of the Stechemet, it was in the style of the Bekiyas of Sephardic rabbis, like Rav Avi Yosef, who was also a tremendous Talmid Chacham. They knew all the Torah, but there's an idea that not as much depth, conceptual depth, as you'd find in a brisker way. Top page 185, the Torah reading in Vilna, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in a Yachei Kal lecture in 1975. I heard from my father that Rav Chaim Brisker told him that when he was a Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, he, Rav Chaim Brisker, once went to Vilna on a visit. It was a Monday or a Thursday, and Rav Chaim went to shul to hear the reading of the Torah. Rav Chaim went into the Kavanasha, the concentration shul, as it was called, the famous round shul. It probably started as the Chedva Kedisha shul. The Chevra Kedisha Shul. Anyway, he prayed there. After the Chazan finished the long Tachanun supplicatory prayer, following the Amidah, he banged on the table and asked, who is a Bokore? Who is able to read from the Torah? the regular Bar Korei had taken sick, and a substitute was needed. A Jew raised his hand, and the cantor asked him to come up. The Jew went up, and the Kohen was called up. The Kohen said the blessing, and the substitute Bar Korei put on his glasses and answered Amen solemnly. He took a look at the Torah scroll and exclaimed, "Why didn't you tell me that the Torah scroll does not have vowel points under the letters?" Laughter in the audience. This is a true story.
Wow.
I'll read it. You'll read it. What makes you think you can read it? Well, because it's probably got nekudos underneath the letters in the Torah scroll. Any bar mitzvah boy knows it's not true. What's going on over there?
The bar mitzvah boy.
What is going on over there?
We're booking back in.
Amazing. Okay. Let's see how much more we can get away with over here. Communal prayer. Oh, it's a long story. This is a long story. No. We're going to have to cut it over here. There's a lot more going on. Okay, Brisker, you got to love him and appreciate him and respect. We're going to have to cut it over here, people. I'm exhausted, and we've already done quite a bit. God willing, next week, we're returning a car. I will make every effort to give the class between 1 and 2. I'll give you guys. Keep you guys posted. Hopefully you enjoyed. Have a good moed, a moedim l'simcha. God willing, tomorrow we're going to continue. We're going to do another class in Midrash. We're going to continue with Midrash. You're welcome to join. I'm going to phone it in. So I'm going to tell the authorities. 10:30 tomorrow morning, we're going to continue with our Midrash class. And there's no reason not to. We want to try to make up some ground that we may have lost because of the holidays. So be here tomorrow, God willing, at 10:30 a.m.
Be there or be square.
Be there or be square. A good moed and a moed l'simcha. Shul Bachar signing off. The government of synagogue and a school of Jewish studies live here in Oppenheimer's in Fleischmann's, New York. Take care and be well. See you tomorrow at 10:30. Bye-bye.